reporter was on the fringe. You don't go in the government. And until the thing opened up that you begin to have, you know. Look at New York Times, my God, they have a black and a south, you know, a couple times.
Yeah.
Same thing. That you couldn't have had one go around the southern. Where could he make the contact that I'm talking about with the white community? And the white community is dominant. You have to make it with them.
And so, for all practical purposes, there was no...
And the black has no influence in changing that damn thing other than his position of how you present him as a victim.
Yeah.
As a godforsaken victim. You know, it's the man being crucified. You have to do that. You have to be aware. You have to deal. But you have to change the white first.
Yeah.
And, you know, it took time.
It couldn't have happened any quicker. That's what you're saying.
I don't think so. No, I don't.
There's not any way that people in...
Well, it could have been maybe some different... People have always... And I agree with him. I didn't feel that Eisenhower was as good as he should have been when he came in. He had a tremendous appeal in the South. And we all had that feeling, many of us, that he could have spoken out, you know. And that's what he didn't do. It's what's in your heart, you know.
Yeah.
And that sort of thing. They could have well taken a... You could have avoided maybe a great deal of the little blow-ups that we had.
When you went to, were you in Philadelphia in 48 at the Democratic Convention?
Yeah, I went up there. I didn't stay very long. I came on down to Birmingham.
You went to Birmingham.
Mm-hmm.
Did that frighten you, what you saw happening? Did you think that this was all going to blow up into some kind of new civil war or something?
Oh, no. I didn't have the feeling that.
You weren't afraid?
I thought they were both a couple of little clowns. They didn't want, you know, I know Strom, and I knew he would. You know, sort of a braggart type, an old paratrooper bouncing around. And then Feeling Right was about as soft and gentle a person you ever wanted to know, a little mild fella, you know. And a lot of damn fun. Of course, you got that, I'm sitting in a room, say, in a place where they're meeting. There's these wild-eyed bastards around, you know. I never paid any attention to them. They never scared me worth it. I never saw them as taking over anything.
You didn't?
Oh,
I mean,
no.
This is in the municipal auditorium in Birmingham.
That's right.
Several thousand people
that's
going
right.
crazy
that's
in
right.
there.
Oh, they're shouting and hollering, that's right.
I mean, this didn't make you think this is another Munich, this is Hitler? This
No, I couldn't take them that seriously.
You thought
I
it was
knew
funny.
Most of them, huh?
You thought it was funny.
Well, it's not funny, but I thought of myself so on the ridiculous side. How the hell are you going to oust all this power? You're going to have a show, you know, and everybody runs and hides a little bit till they rearrange the chips on the pieces on the chessboard. And you saw that happen.
Yeah.
You saw that happen. One state accepts, one rejects, all over one more time, and that's all there is to it. A little dregs left over. You can't oust anything as powerful as the goddamn Democratic Party was in the South in those days. And a Republican president who's absolutely wonderful to them. He's the great hero and everything. What the hell are these loudmouthed little bastards going to mean? And they holler and scream. You one thing, you know that. You from the South. Don't take that damn language too seriously.
Well, did you, by the same token then, did you think that ultimately the position of the National Democrats and of blacks was going to become the country's position, including the South?
It's going to become what?
Was that going to be the winning card down the road?
But later on they would
yeah.
come?
I mean, if you weren't frightened by these guys in 48, did you think the other side was going to win? The other side was Hubert Humphrey and Lillian Smith and the liberals and the blacks and...
They didn't have a chance in the South at that time. The emotions were so high, you know.
Okay, so what did you think was going to happen when you heard these guys shouting in the auditorium in Birmingham? If you weren't frightened, what did you think was going to happen, Pop? Where was this going? Where was this all going?
Well, I think, you know, they're shouting and hollering and running up and down with the Confederate flags and that sort of shit, which didn't disturb me any of it. And then I got with Strom's sermon and, you know, had a little talk with him and he pleaded, you know, the usual stuff. And women, we're not racist. You want to treat us seriously, you know, all that sort of thing. I had to listen to that shit, you know. I got to absorb that. I didn't argue. I'm not going to argue with him. And Feeling was a nice little fella, and then they went on back home, and then my next assignment, essentially, was to go around to the different states and sound them out and cover them with a campaign. I went to, I told you that story when I went to Virginia that time, and roamed all over the damn place from place to place, and I got to feeling, and then I got into Fredericksburg. And I got talking to one of my friends there, and he said, well, he said, I'll tell you something interesting, Pop. He said, this is just a few weeks before the election. He said they had a straw poll at the high school. Kids, you know, 14, 15, 16, 17. And he said Truman won like 2-1. So he said, you know, I said, I don't think the sentiment, I think it's for Truman around here. And I said, well, I'm getting something comparable to that around the places I talk to. A lot of talk and screaming and this and that sort of thing. But he said, you know, of course, they ought to reflect what their parents are going to vote. They're not going to vote. But usually, you know, it's usually a good sign. So then after I'd summed it all up, I wrote a story in which I said that Mr. Truman was very likely would not carry Virginia. He just seemed to, you know, be running a little behind. So I got a call the day after that story appeared. And the National News editor was a very good friend of mine, said that Mr. Crock, who was living next door to Harry Byrd in those days, the big Washington man, you know, who's from Kentucky, Glasgow,
yeah.
And said that I was quite wrong. That state was Virginia was strong and all that sort of thing. Critical of my story. I said, well, hell, I'm from here. At least I said, I know these people. I'll just have to stand on them. So nothing took place, but Virginia stayed with Truman and Maryland went to
for
the others. So I'm just saying, you get the feeling, you walk around and then talk to different people. I couldn't see the damn thing. I mean, the 2,000 hollering in the hall didn't mean it. There wasn't any television.
Yeah.
Wasn't anything you could see. I don't know. And then when I began to go down, calm down, and you found the same thing. Here's a guy on the corner. Oh, damn, put those neckers into place. Got to do this and that. And you got another one says, oh, hell, I'm not, you know, I'm not for the black or anything, but I'm not going to go for that shit.
Yeah.
And an awful lot of them began, you know, it's amazing how many and nice people. I'm not dumb, but I just plain people always felt that Strom and feeling were just, you know, just kind of load of shit. It's all kind of load of shit. Now, Strom was not an appealing person on the stand around the rest of the South.
Right.
He said that in a little slightly overbearing way. It was hard to understand with that damn accent. All over Virginia, Kentucky couldn't understand the 7 bit when it talked. You know, and then of course, Feeling was such a modest little man, you didn't feel like he could lead you anywhere.
That was in July, Birmingham.
Yeah.
When was it that Wallace made the trip through and you went with him? Was it after that?
When Wallace made the trip where?
The campaign tour. Henry Wallace.
Oh, Henry Wallace. Oh, it's been about around the same time, I guess. It must have been afterward, I guess. Must have been that, because we were over in North Carolina, and then we went on out there. It must have been probably closer to all. Well, I tell you, as a matter of fact, we stopped and got some watermelon, I remember.
How long did you travel with him?
From the time he came south until he finished.
Like
he started out, and I picked him up. I picked him up in Raleigh or Chapel Hill, whichever it was, North Carolina.
Got on the train with him.
Well, I got over there and picked him up. He had a speech that night, and that's when somebody fired a couple of pistols in the air and scared everybody to death, you know, over one of the big meetings. And things were nasty words all over. So then I got on the train. I'd taken a train from here to North Carolina, that's right, and I picked him up. And I stayed with him on the train and the bus.
Tell me the itinerary.
Frozen bus, huh?
Tell me the itinerary.
Oh, Lord, I don't know.
Roughly.
We went down to South Carolina. And then there was I guess we were going to go by car or something, my recollection. And so they said, it's just too damn desperate. It's too hot. You're going to get killed, all of you. So go through Alabama and Mississippi and on up to Little Rock. don't stop. We went by automobile. At an entourage, you know, and so we went through them.
From North Carolina, where did you go?
What I'm saying, from North Carolina to South Carolina, I think it was, and then we crossed
Georgia
and Alabama and Mississippi.
I see.
And got up to Little Rock, and that's where Harry Ashmore interviewed him on a television thing.
This was maybe a week's time?
About a week, all of it, about a week or so, yeah.
Do you remember other people being on that? On that trip, any Southern journalists?
Most of it just picked somebody up in the town in which you stopped, you know.
Was Jonathan Daniels traveling?
And boy, from the Washington Post is a very good friend of mine, an old timer. I can't even won a Pulitzer Prize in Atlanta years ago.
Was he from Atlanta?
No, he's from Washington, comes from an old family in Washington. Down in Foggy Bottom, New Potemkin. Grew up in Foggy Bottom.
Was Jonathan Daniels traveling with Truman?
Oh, with Truman? I don't know. I don't know whether he was or not. I couldn't tell you at the time.
And everywhere you stopped, there was opposition?
Oh, yeah, somebody be protesting everywhere, you know. We had a police escort going across those states there where they said it was going to be so bad. State police gave us escorts, and we got on up to Little Rock and we stayed there for a couple of days. And when we left Little Rock, we were still under great protest. And we came down Little Rock, and we stopped and had a watermelon feast out on the side of the road. So we put watermelon on the side of the road. We ate the damn watermelon. So it must have been in August or September, I guess.
Did you run into any trouble, or was it just talk of trouble?
Well, most of it is just, you know, shouting and hollering. We had some guy fired a pistol over in North Carolina. And we got on a train, and then they tell us, get off the train. And then they tell us you got to get on a side road and eat lunch, you know. And we had that guitar player, Seger.
Pete Seger.
Hmm?
Pete
Seger. And he'd sing these goddamn wood stories, you know, songs.
Battle.
Folk songs, that sort of thing. And we'd sit out there in the woods, eat, have a lunch, a box lunch or something, and then we'd get back and get on a bus, because he had a black secretary with him. That drove him all crazy as hell when they heard he had a black secretary riding in his train and in his car.
Did you see it then and describe it in your pieces as a hopeless will-o'-the-wisp, Don Quixote
I just wrote the straight news story. I didn't write any. Times didn't have, in those days, the news analysis and all that kind of stuff.
Did you personally see it as a hopeless case?
Wallace, you mean? Oh, yes.
It was just absolutely out of the question.
No, you couldn't help but think, what the hell is this going about to be a damn thing at all?
What was he like, Pop?
A very amiable, very pleasant person, a big burly type of farm type, you know.
Did you think of him as a radical?
Not to me, he wasn't. No, he was a radical maybe to people here because he was open to the black or that sort of thing. But I understood he was a radical in the sense of the farm background in America, you know. He came out of a farm radical family of its day. When you talk about farm people as radicals. But the ideas they have on their land and their ownership and that. He came out of that family, kind of a very noted agricultural adjusting family.
Yeah.
I knew him as a radical in the sense opposing that against the capitalist world. I'm familiar with that world. So I knew him as a radical in that sense. But to see him as a radical in the communist sense or something was silly, I thought. He had some tough people here. What, that guy died up in Charlottesville was with us not long ago.
Palmer Weber. Palmer Weber.
I think Palmer Weber was on the train with us. And I can't think
any
of
other Southerner?
What's his name? Another one who later became editor of the New York Post was on the train with us.
Wexler?
That's it. Wexler. He was on the train with us.
Any other Southerners?
Well, they weren't Southerners.
No. Well, Palmer Weber, I guess. Kind of halfway qualified.
Yeah, sort of halfway, I guess, yeah. I don't know. We just picked them up at different places, you know, wherever they were.
Then the Southern governors met again in Savannah that December after the election. Went to Savannah.
Did we go to Savannah?
Yeah. And you know, Thurman and Wright and old Laney from Arkansas, that's about all they could carry. Most of these other governors wiggled out of it somehow.
Oh, yeah, they didn't pay attention to it, no.
If
they met there in
Earl Long.
Met in Jackson, Mississippi, and the damn thing was a blow-up there, really. Nobody paid that much attention. That was when they formed the party. The nomination brought it to a sharp at that, you know.
Yeah. But you just really didn't take it seriously, did you?
I didn't see it as any winning hand, no. Not when you see the whole damn South.
Because there's Earl Long. See, he didn't go with him. Jim Folsom didn't go with him.
They got too much at stake. And
even Talmadge didn't go with him.
Not a damn bit, my God. The structure, the party, the patronage, the whole damn deal. And they're suddenly going to have me say Strom Thurmond and Feeling Wright are going to run us out, run me out of it. Pull aside, let the sumbitch sound off, huh? You don't take over the South that way. The things that help take over the South don't have a hell of a lot to do with the politics, as you know.
Right.
Manufacturing, highways, expanding communities, you know, moving to the South, all that changed. University, I came here in 1947, average state university had about, major state university, about 7,500 students at the most. Now they're running away from 25 to 40,000. 5,000 every damn one of the big ones come from somewhere from Oregon to New Hampshire.
Let me ask you
all
about
the things that have changed in that time. That one made the South change an enormous amount.
Let's talk about the universities for a minute. In 1948, a bunch of Howard Odum's proteges and Rupert Vance's proteges, John Ivey, John Folger,
wonderful people,
Bob Anderson,
shot up with them night after night.
Lynn Godwin. There were all of them out of UNC. They became the nucleus of the staff.
Ivy was the brain.
Southern Regional Council.
That's right.
Now, tell me if I'm right about this. The governors created SREB as a dodge against integration. That was the primary thing in their minds. This is how we beat the rap. But they hired a staff of sort of liberal progressive people who very subtly led it in a different direction. And it got away from that. The staff was more in the modern current of change in the South. The governors were still trying to buy time to get out of having to desegregate. And so they said, we'll put money in a veterinary school at Tuskegee so we don't have to have black students go to the veterinary school at Auburn. And we'll put money in Howard University Medical School in Meharry so we don't have black students going to University of North Carolina. And they thought that was a good idea. And that was what motivated them to do that at the time they did it. Does that make sense?
It's a measure of it, a sense, yes. It's mixed up. We met in Asheville, North Carolina, and the chairman was the governor from Florida, Millard Caldwell, very lovely man, big, strong, but fine person, and you know, in that setting. And I think it was the governor from Tennessee, I'm pretty sure who it was, that was the governor, you know, in 1948, we'll say.
When would that have been?
47 or 48. It's the one that preceded the one that was elected in 48. The one who was elected was the...
Well, Clement.
Yes, no, Clement came after that.
Came later.
Yeah,
I'm having trouble thinking who it
Clarence's, was. Francis, the brother, was his campaign manager. Not for this one, but the one that came in at the wartime. Who was that? Browning.
Browning.
No, the man that preceded Browning. Can't think of his name. country type boy.
Yeah, I'm ashamed to say I don't know.
I can't remember it even. I don't see if we have a look up that.
That's all right. That's all right. I can look that up.
Yeah, but
anyway.
Anyhow, he was out.
So,
and somehow the subject came up of Meharry Medical College was in trouble. And he brought up the point about what could they do to help them, you know. And Millet Caldwell said, I want to take an adjournment. And he said to me, he said, if you can help me any or anything, he said, please do. He said, I don't want to get anything out on what this means at this time, but he said, I have some ideas about this thing.
What did his ideas turn out to be?
Then it turned out that what he had done was recommend that we form a committee to look into the Meharry thing, and that we think in terms of a regional education approach, bringing others in. Now, he didn't say specifically, do this for Howard, but do the Tuskegee, the veterinary school had not come up at that time or anything of that sort. The idea was to meet with the Meharry people and see what we could do in helping out the region. He didn't say race or anything of that, just, you know, helping out. But obviously, it was a black school there. And then we had regional problems. We weren't as strong as we should be in the South in our education. We needed to draw and pool on our resources. And so they arranged a meeting in Nashville, seemed to me like the next month or something, 2 months or whatever, it was in Nashville, of 4 or 5 of these governors, and went out to Meharry and looked the place over and talked to the leaders. And we met in Nashville. Harry Ashmore was there at a meeting. I was there, a whole lot of us. And they came to the conclusion they would do something about it. And so somewhere along the line, they came up with the idea of John Ivey, who was an advanced thinker on these things, and a couple of others. And so that would have been in
47.
And I guess the following year, you know, we met in the 48. Yeah, I guess so. And I don't know, an exploratory work, and I know that we met in Savannah, Georgia.
Yeah. December 48.
And December 48, we met in Savannah, Georgia, and what's his name? Herman got loaded. He was there.
Talmage.
Yeah, and it sent him upstairs or something. The guy ran a Cadillac firm in Savannah and used to take care of him all the time. And we met there, but they brought with them. That's where this thing didn't quite come off. They brought with them, I guess he's in Savannah. They brought with them a black college representative. Black presidents came there. I think Carmen was upset about it, probably. I don't know, but that was it. And you had black and you had white, and they were sitting down and debated in the 1948 on how they would form a regional effort to improve education in the South. And they talked at Meharry as a continuing black medical school. I think the veterinary thing may have come up, not in the governor's conference, maybe in some of the other things that they developed about building a veterinary school in Tuskegee. And then we're going to build one in Tennessee, you know. And in other words, there'll be one of the ideas was to have a wonderful interchange, so that if you went in a state that had no veterinary school, your state could pay whatever would be the be in the tuition, and you could go to that school.
Right.
So many were allowed. It was a whole idea. Ivy was thinking it up. Ivy was a very brilliant man that way. Then he brought in these other people with him. You know, John, what's his name?
Folger.
John Folger. Well, and of course, Ed Crawford.
Yeah.
the other guy that later became the head just stepped down as the head of the Southern Regional
Lynn
Education.
Lynn Godwin.
And all of them. Well, we nosed around. You had to work very hard with it. It was an awful lot of disgruntlement that came out of the East that this was going to be a racial thing. You know? This was going to be a racial thing.
Right.
And a lot of suspicion about it. And I was very close to Ivy and the rest of them, and I knew they didn't want anything like this, and they were going to turn it around. And we went to Annapolis, Maryland. We had some kind of a meeting up there with the Southern governors and this education people. And I went up there, and I wrote a story for the Times, and I assured my desk, don't get excited, these people are going to do something. And they wrote a good story there. And Bob Anderson was there at that meeting in Annapolis, and we stayed there. And I don't know, they had some resolution or something that was adopted that showed that it was going to be broad-based. The fact that Meharry had to stay a black school had nothing to do with the Southern Regional Governors. That's within your state context before the courts open them up. And so then we moved on from then with the Southern Regional Education Board. Then we began to have meetings and that sort of thing, independent, you know, on different days and established. And I served on several of their committees in
right.
the early days.
Right.
And very, very one that I served on and I cared a great deal about it was in connection with your regional education, you know, and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And then I was the only newsman, I guess, ever was named to the Southern Association of Colleges and Schools, you know, the rating group for the whole South.
Right.
And I served on that for several years.
Yeah.
What's his name was there at the meeting in the Popham Seminar the other day.
Yeah, Felix Robb.
That's right. Felix Robb put me on that damn board when he became the president of it. So I worked very closely with all of them, and I knew the dialogue and the meeting, and you had this and that, but I would say from the beginning, there wasn't any idea of a hard-nosed strategy, let's keep independent. And I think Millard Caldwell felt good. There was sort of a feeling, whatever it is, we're going to do something better. I think there was a feeling that, you know, whether some would think, well, I'm going to keep black or some of the other. But you were willing to take some steps.
Yeah,
and the fundamental thing that made John Ivey and the rest of those people your name was, you were talking about a regional education thing. A regional education. Weak states and strong states. Wealth in one place and not in another.
Yeah.
And we've got to find some way to create a link. And so all the governors would meet, and then we had several special meetings on the side.
Yeah.
I can't think of the guy's name from Georgia and another one from Mississippi that was so outstanding, and I used to deal with them all the time. How do you bring these things together? How do you talk a legislature, you know, with the wild-eyed, I hate the black group of the legislature against the white? All of that went on for a long time. So there was a lot of goodwill and evil will, and it came together, but the good won out.
Yeah. And some more people I want to bring up. There was a journalist named Edgar Ray at the Tampa Times. He was on the Southern Regional Council Board for a while. He was on the National Urban League. He used to go around making speeches a lot, sort of racial reconciliation. Did you ever know him?
Edgar Ray, doesn't place him now.
Mark Etheridge and Barry Bingham.
Oh, well, I knew both of them very well, yeah.
Mark Etheridge was at Macon, you recall? He came from Macon.
Oh, he came from Macon originally,
yeah.
Yes. He came from Macon, Georgia. His wife came from down in Savannah.
And he ended up at the Courier-Journal.
Yeah, he was the general manager. That's why I had a term manager, whatever it was.
Yeah.
He was the big wheel. He'd been at Richmond Times-Dispatch, and Franklin Roosevelt got him that job down there.
Uh-huh. How'd that happen?
Well, my recollection was that he had gone to the Richmond Times-Dispatch, and they were supporting Franklin Roosevelt. And Now, maybe they'd gotten him over there, but in any event, he was influential in getting Franklin Roosevelt to appoint Barry Bingham's father ambassador to London. And I think that he broke that thing off in some way and then got the job over there. I've just forgotten how those went together. But then he became the big man there for a long time, and he was a very influential newsman in this part of the country in his day. Very lovely person.
A liberal?
Oh, yes. A liberal in the V. Dabney and, you know, that sort of thing. He wasn't from that thing, but, I mean, he was liberal. He was liberal enough for Kentucky. Yeah, he was all right. He was a good voice.
What about Walter White? Did you know him?
Oh, God, knew him well, yeah. You mean the NAACP man? Well, you know, everybody thought he was white. He looked just like a white man. Everybody used to kid him all the time. He was a fast-talking, quick guy, you know, nice fellow, very nice. I enjoyed him very much. What the hell was it?
He was from Atlanta, wasn't he?
Yeah, from Atlanta, I think so, yeah. He and his wife, they had a big meeting down there one time. I went to the dinner with them that they had afterward in that multi-millionaire black contractor down there in Atlanta. You remember his name? He built all the buildings and he named a damn big building down there after his family, name of two or three daughters. The multi-millionaire black contractor.
I don't know who that is.
Yeah, oh, he was a big wheel in Atlanta in his day. And he held a big dinner, went out to his house, he had his own soda fountain in the snap in the basement of his home, you know.
Walter White.
Walter White's wife was with him.
You think of him as being a Southerner?
Oh, yes, yes, I would think so. Oh, yes. He was a fast-talking, clever little fellow, you know.
Was he sincere?
As far as I know, he was. He was in New York all the time. I'd only see him when he came south, you know. But he was always very nice. He'd frequently call me on the phone and ask my judgment or something. You know, what did I think of this? Some Southerner would act up and, you know, he won't know his, you know, in other words, just what you asked, is that true? Is he covering up or what does he mean? I said, well, you know, as far as I know, I think it's just a front right now to cover him up for running for election or whatever it be. That sort of thing. I found him all right.
What about W.E.B. Du Bois?
No, he came out before my time. He wasn't active in the South in those days. But Walter White was a pleasant fellow, very funny, good sense of humor.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, and of course, the real worker on the damn thing was his general manager there. What the hell was his name? You know.
Yeah. Wilkins.
Wilkins, yeah. Roy Wilkins. He was awfully nice.
There was a lynching in Toombs County, Georgia,
yeah,
in 48.
Yeah, I didn't cover that.
Wondered if you remembered about it. Did you? Were you bothered by the violence, the viciousness of the lynchings? I mean, the miscarriage of justice that was involved.
I covered one in Mississippi and covered the execution, you know, and this and that, Willie McGee. And I covered that, covered the execution and all. But, you know, it's not pleasant, but I wouldn't want to do it again.
Did you have a sense of injustice being perpetrated by...
Oh, God, yes, yes. Oh, yes. Such hatred would usually be in the court. Where it involved white and black conflict. And so often where the white woman's the victim or something, you know. Oh. The hatred and the ugliness and the sullenness and the people that are looking at you when they're a reporter. You know, they didn't have any damn use for you that way. They never had a use for you then. When you get out on that really extra fringe crowd out there, they can be kind of nasty. You got to know how to handle yourself with them. You got to know what kind of bullshit to sling before so you can have time enough to get out of there.
The communists and the socialists, they were really different, weren't they?
You mean in the South?
On the American political scene.
Oh, yes, yes, yes. The communists in the sense of Marxism, I mean, Soviet brand of communism is a all wild. Well, you can just see now what it did, the dirt, the filth, the ugliness, the cruelty, the pain, the agony, the lie everywhere. Socialist comes in several different forms out of Europe. One is Fabian Socialist, which was well respected in some way by liberals in this country coming out of England, you know. Then, of course, you have the socialism in Central Europe. And you take right this moment, you have five socialist governments over there now. But all five are what they call social democrats. And all five of them said, we want this open market economy and all that sort of damn thing. That's quite a show. Socialism is vastly different, and we don't have many people that know much about it in this country and its history.
Back then, we had some Southern people who thought of themselves as socialists.
Oh, yes, we've always had that, in our day. As I said, it came in many forms. Mr. Crump was really almost like a form of socialism. It went right on a socialist ticket.
The Longs.
Huh?
The Longs. The Longs in Louisiana.
Well, his was a form of socialism. Mr. Crump ran on one to went out there in Memphis. And you had Eugene V. Debs in his covered wagon and going across the country and people clapping and caring about him. You had Mr. Hirsch ran on a damn socialist ticket in New York for mayor, for God's sake, at one time. Many, many years ago, we came with all kinds of, particularly during the agrarian movement, in this country. And that, of course, became the early aspect in the South, with what's his name from Georgia? What I'm talking about.
Yeah.
And he later turned against the whole, the populist man.
Yeah, Ben Tillman.
No,
that's South Carolina. Watson.
That's
Tom
it, Watson. Tom Watson. And Tom Watson, Jim Folsom's father was a delegate to a damn socialist meeting in Nashville, Tennessee. Back in his day, it was all lots of protesting. And then you had so many little communities of withdrawal, these little things that came out of Norway and Sweden, craft, your old work, and everything. What's the name, Highland School up there?
Highlander folks.
Yeah, they picked it all over the damn place. So I was around the place. You go back to the turn of the century, it was something, that galvanized people.
Politics was more interesting then. it was certainly more varied.
It was interesting. It just wasn't as fouled up as it is today. You could see the lines. But you had socialists everywhere. My God, we had socialist candidates in the New York State Legislature. Then they all got thrown out. One of them was a rewrite man with me on a newspaper. Another was a dear friend of mine who ran for mayor. Then they became a magistrate up there. I used to sit up and talk with him. We ended the night. He got thrown out of that legislature. Oh, hell, those things took place all the time.
What about Stetson Kennedy? Did you know him?
Who?
Stetson Kennedy. Stetson Kennedy.
How do you spell that first name?
S-T-E-T-S-O-N.
Stetson Kennedy, no, I don't.
He was a writer, kind of a freelance. He wrote a book called Southern Exposure, came out in 1947.
Oh, that's right, yes, the book, that's right. I don't think
Did
I knew
Did you ever know him?
No, I don't think so.
And Truman's Committee on Civil Rights that Frank Porter Graham and Mrs. Tilly down at
Mrs.
SRC.
Mrs. Emmy Tilly?
They were both on that committee. And
she was the daughter of a Confederate.
Is that right?
Mrs. Emmy Tilly with a little hat on her head, sit down and check all these black trials, and that sort of thing. Yeah, Mrs. Emmy Tilly, daughter of a Confederate Army officer.
When Truman's initiatives on civil rights became sort of part of his administration, who was responsible for that? Who was advising Harry Truman to take a hard line on civil rights?
That would have been in 1947,
46, 7, and 8.
That's right, I don't know. I wasn't in the country in the 46, and in the 47 early. I couldn't say offhand. Do you have any suggestions?
Well, I'm wondering how much influence people like Will Alexander had on Harry Truman, or Aubrey Williams.
There were Southerners. They were in the administration.
Will Alexander was a very wonderful person, you know. I knew Will. And he's the first one to talk me into drinking a Sazerac cocktail in New Orleans. Back in 47, yeah. Will Alexander. I don't know. I never got the idea that he would have had the influence on Truman. I don't think he was that close to influence him. And I'm not sure that Aubrey Williams would have been the one. He was a Roosevelt man, you know.
So maybe the influence came out of the North.
I'd more likely just come out of his own damn political savvy that this is the time to change a little.
Yeah.
The war, to change the climate that we were in. And he just saw it as a positive thing. Just political savvy.
Yeah.
He's a shrewd little politician.
Yeah, he didn't have any particular feeling about it, I don't think.
I don't think so, one way or the other. He never thumped or anything.
No, I don't think
he
so.
He real soft. He just took a stand. That's the right thing to do. We'll do it. And of course, I guess he could have also been one who didn't think it was going to go beyond that anyhow.
Yeah, this is possible.
Probably possible.
I have trouble finding any body of people who were influential
in his racial attitude.
Southerners, yeah. I can't identify. Jonathan Daniels wouldn't have led him in that direction, would he?
Now, you know, in those days, you had American Mercury still around, Scribner's, Atlantic, and Harper's, and various others. A good many of these people, like the Jonathan, all wrote articles for them once in a while.
Dabney did a lot.
They all would write for them a great deal, you know. So you saw them as influential men, but it's hard for me to believe they influenced Harry Truman.
Yeah, it's hard for me to believe, too.
I don't believe they
influenced
him.
Sure,
they were just plain political savvy, the thing to do. All he's talking about, essentially, of course, was integrating the military forces.
Some people say there was a terrible lynching in Monroe, Georgia, in 46.
Mm-hmm.
Two young veterans, young black men in their early 20s, and their wives, four people, riding in a car with a white farmer who had hired these two guys to work for him, and they were going out to his place. So they were in the car with him. You have to assume that somebody sitting in the front seat, you wouldn't have four people crammed into the back of this car, you know, and a white guy driving it. They're driving along a country road outside of Monroe, Georgia, and they come to an old iron bridge, one-lane bridge, start across the bridge, and at the other end they see 25 or 30 white guys wearing robes, no hoods, and they stop them. And they have reason to think that one of these guys has been in a fight with a white man and whipped up on him. And so they're going to straighten him out. And they get him out of the car, all of them. And one of the young women recognizes one of these white guys. They're leading the two black guys off into the woods. And the woman screams and says, "Mr. So-and-so, please don't harm my husband. He didn't do anything." So the guy realizes these women know who he is. They've identified him. And he says, "Bring them too." And they take them over in the woods, four of them, and shoot them, kill them all. It caused a big sensation. It was in all the newspapers. Tom Clark was the attorney general.
Mm-hmm.
He sent the FBI down. They couldn't get anywhere. The white farmer said he didn't know any of these guys. Nobody was arrested. Harry Truman apparently was so outraged by this act
that he formed that committee that summer. He said, we're going to have a committee. We're going to make some changes, just like you said. The time, they pushed him too far.
Well, be the damn thing.
I think
he had that kind of character.
Yeah, if you made him mad, he'd get up and kick your ass.
Born a man, Southerner, but it's a dirty thing, and I'll change the stamp. You won't do this anymore. That would have been as far as he wanted to go.
Yeah.
That's all he had.